But this was a lesson to us that if we want to do something effectively, we have to use our day, the committee day, as well as the committee day is Wednesday. Hoping that our apology has been accepted. We know that we learn by doing mistakes. In future, we'll try and correct us. The Constitution mandates us as parliaments to amend, to reject, and also to make the laws, to oversight over the executive, and to ensure the public participation in all the legislative processes, and to, you know, to consider the international arguments and treaties. In most cases, laws are being initiated by the executive, as indicated in Section 250 of the Constitution and also the rules of the House. But the committee also has got the right, individual members of the right to initiate the law. Furthermore, Section 92 of the Constitution, which talk about the accountability and responsibilities, where members of cabinet are accountable collectively and individually to parliament for exercising their powers and the performance of their functions. Accountability can be done in various ways. As you know that the department is to submit quarterly reports, annual reports. Members have to ask the questions to the executive authority, either written or oral questions, where the executive authority is responding to those questions. That is one way of oversighting the department. In most cases, we conduct the oversight visits to various provinces to see whether the projects that the department has promised to implement are being implemented effectively, engaging various stakeholders to hear their views about the implementation of the project. The committee is also mandated by Section 59, Section 1 of the Constitution to facilitate public involvement in legislative issues and other issues of the Assembly and its committee. Such as the holding of the public hearings when there's a bill that is in front of us, or when we want to hear the views of the public about any project that is in that particular locality. And also through even meetings, that is one way of also ensuring or of strengthening the public involvement in all the processes. And also to hear the views of the people if there's any legislation that has been presented to the committee for the public to have their views. The committee is expected also to conduct its business in an open manner, holding committee meetings in an open manner and let the committee decide otherwise by the administration. As what we need in the committee meetings, where members of the public come and observe but not participate in the committee sessions. To strengthen our oversight, various institutions have been established through Section 9 of the Constitution. Those institutions have been created to oversight and monitor the performance of the various departments, which we call the Chapter 9 institutions, such as the Auditor General, the Public Protector, and other external stakeholders, which also are assisting in monitoring the performance of the department. These institutions are independent and impartial. They must exercise their power and functions without fear, favor, and prejudice. Furthermore, as a committee, we have to make sure that we build a good relationship with those institutions, we communicate, we involve them in our committee meetings to get their advice and also their guidance. The other one is to ensure that we work with other committees to strengthen our oversight, such as the Committee on Public Accounts, to ensure that the public has been protected, to ensure whether there is value for money in the implementation of the departmental progress, to ensure that the funds are being used economically, effectively, and efficiently. For the benefit of the people, as we've been elected to serve the people. Rule 137 and Rule 1 and 2 gives the committee the responsibility to account to Parliament on its activities. For the portfolio committee, therefore, to be able to execute its mandate, it must have the strategic plan, the annual performance plan, which is aligned to the strategic plan of Parliament. Secondly, it must work together with the department. The department must ensure that reports are submitted on time, attend all the committee meetings, respond to the questions as raised by the members of Parliament. Therefore, this session will assist us to deepen our mandate for us to achieve that. We need to have a clear plan which is implementable. We must remember that we are not the department, we are the committee. So our mandate is in the Constitution and also in the House of Parliament. Lastly, the objective of this session is for the committee to develop a strategic and operational framework for effective oversight. The session will assist us to consider various policy pronouncements from the department in conjunction with relevant policy, and also to scan the policy context that impacts on the mandate of the department, which is rural development and land reform. Therefore, we need to work together to make sure that we build a good relationship with the department and entities and other Chapter 9 institutions. We need also to make sure that we track all the House resolutions, because there were other committees looking at the legacy reports of the previous committee. We have to make sure that we make follow-ups on other issues which were not finalized by the previous committee. Through the tracking of the resolutions, we'll be able to make an assessment of the committee, whether are we making it or are we breaking it. Because if we not monitor or track the resolutions of the previous committee and the resolution of this committee, we'll keep on making, you know, one and the same recommendation for 5 years. But at the end of the day, those recommendations or resolutions not being implemented by the department and its entities. I therefore declare this session officially open and welcome everyone who is here, hoping that this session will benefit us a lot. Thank you very much, Honorable Madea.
Thank you very much, Honorable Chairperson. Chairperson has said the context and purpose for today's workshop. In order to make up, we will immediately welcome the next speaker. Just before we do that, I just want to welcome our Work Portal Committee, Honorable Mguni, who just joined us. Mr. Sabit, will you be leading us? The floor is yours. Thank you very much.
Honourable members, colleagues, thank you very much. May I first attend an apology on behalf of the Minister, Deputy Ministers and the Director General today at the Cabinet of Hopla, which commenced today, and so they are unavailable. I will go straight into my presentation, and I'll try and be as brief as possible, Honourable members. In terms of the request that was sent to the department, we basically have put the presentation into three parts, in which we have a look on our performance of the last five years, and then we go into projections 2019-2020, and then a little bit of commentary about the legislation and policy we have that is driving at this particular moment, and cost implications. I want to, anything that we said, project the legislation and our ABD going forward and strategic plan are currently under review, and given the adjustments we've had to factor in a letter we got from Treasury last week with regard to our budget allocation. So the Minister and the DG have required us to take a look at it and see if we are able to still perform and carry out the program projects that we had indicated in our draft APP, mindful of the fact that I think we have to table our APP in about a month's time to Portfolio Committee and Department. So if I look backwards, in 2009, I think this is familiar to most people in the room, the rural development landform was created with some of its key priorities identified as follows: compliance with Government Immovable Asset Management Act, abbreviated as GIAMA later on in the presentation. Then to improve land use management, to improve access to infrastructure, to contribute towards poverty alleviation, unemployment reduction, skills development, job creation, implementing land redistribution development, developing an enabling policy and legislative framework to support implementation. And then you'll see in the next slide, and we've got our vision and our mission, also familiar to most people, but I want to emphasize the strategic goals of the department, which we've captured in our program that we have, which follow those 7 strategic goals. In terms of good corporate governance, you are mindful of the fact that we've moved from getting, and I see Eugene here from the Auditor General, from qualified audits over the last 2 to 3 years, we've had unqualified audits, and so there's been a huge emphasis in the department in terms of corporate governance and training our level. So the long way to go, we'll be the last to admit or certain that we've made that we're there where we want to be. There have been lots of hiccups. There have been lots of things that we've had to resolve, sort out, and being relatively young, we've had to learn pretty fast. Over the last 5 years, when you join the old Land Affairs Department, you've been land reform and you try and put in place projects and plans to just change the lay of the land in the country has been huge. You all know I'm new to the department, not that new anymore, but it's been a huge learning experience. Massive learning, just to realize what it is that we have to do to transform land ownership and land reform in the country. So our programs in the department are structured around those seven strategic goals. So as requested by the committee, we go into programs and limitations to the implementation of policy. I'm going to give you the broad overview. I'm not going to go through each of the slides in detail, just in terms of settlement of labor tenant trends. Committee aware that it's been it's fraught with difficulty. If my memory serves me, we were in court last week, we're going to court this week on this whole issue. These claims to be settled through the settlement and land acquisition grants, which basically tended to be lower for households, and resulted in the redistribution grants being used since 2002. Again, fraught with a whole lot of difficulties. And then the most important thing, I think, is on the slide number, the intervention was publicly measured for the first time only when we talk about the labor tenant issue in 2013 to 2014. Hence, there were insufficient dedicated resources for delivery. The necessary infrastructure for delivery is only being put in place now in the department. However, we wanted to alert the committee to the fact that our CLE budget, last week we're informed, I think, will be cut over the M50 to the tune of 800 million rand by Treasury. So over the next couple of years, we're having to really look how we actually do much more with less resources. We're not being allowed to create any new posts. We're not being allowed to fill certain vacancies. And so I had a task in the department at the moment, which sat until late yesterday, in terms of looking at the impact of this and the budget cut on the department's ability to deliver. We're very optimistic. We've been very creative in terms of how we actually execute the mandate of government with regard to transformation on the land issue in the country. So having said that, while we thought we were getting just on track with regard to the labour tenant issue, we did hold that we have a problem with funding in terms of vacancies that we have. When we go to the number of communal property associations reported to be compliant with legislation, another vexing thing in our profile, because for a couple of years there's been very little progress, and now there's been a concerted effort to get them to be functional. Two main issues with regard to PPA is the capacity of these organizations, associations, basically do the work that they're required to do. And the second, and that is the responsibility I think the department has finally accepted that we have to take on board. And you need to see this within the context of the District Land Reform Committee that we are establishing, and a whole lot of those structures we're trying to put in place. The department ultimately, and I think the pending legislation makes provision for this, is that we have to provide capacity to these people on these CPAs to be able to execute their function and do the work that they're responsible for. The very first compliance status report was done in 2009-2010, when there were already more than 1,200 CPAs in existence. The extent of complications within CPAs, the other party, the conflict, the community conflict within the CPAs, requires a whole different approach towards conflict resolution. So you basically have to bring on board experts in conflict resolution to be able to deal with that kind of conflict in the CPAs, and be looking at that. Then I think basically that's about the CPAs. Then we go to number of land parcels confirmed as vested, 6,359 from 2009 to December 2015. This basically relates to the department's controlled land parcels where vesting certificates are being issued to confirm ownership by national government. And again, you won't basically understand or the enormity of the problem that were caused by the apartheid regime unless you're personally working with these issues and the allies. The fact that we didn't have a complete deed title base for your homeland and all those things. So you basically have to go in there and legally hate those things. And as you encounter problems, you basically have to come up with solutions to those problems so that you get the whole picture of land ownership in the country complete. So there we go to accuracy and completeness of the immovable asset register. We've done that and 100% has been completed in 2012-13. You'll also remember that this is one of the big things that led us to getting qualified orders from the Auditor General in previous years. We try to maintain that and keep it 100% accurate as we, every year. Set land made available for sustainable unit settlements, 12,379 hectares since April 2009. And now we have basically got an agreement with the Ministry of Human Settlements to make land available for outcome number 8. The big thing over the last year or so, 2 years, has been this improved cooperation in terms of intergovernmental relations between national departments, and we see that in other things that we talk about, and then between all scales of government. This department has taken a leading role with regard to agricultural reform when it comes to your district municipalities in provinces across the country. Then we have proactive land acquisition, 1.4 million hectares in terms of land acquisition over the last 5 years. What we're encountering now is two things, problems that we're encountering. At the moment, people hear that we're in the market for people to try to build land acquisition now. Going to farmer field development, so we've trained 2,202 farmers. privatize the East Africa Development Program. They define the terms of their strategic partners, and I'm sure you're familiar with them. Who has problems with their strategic partners and to the farmers of development job creation. The privatize the implementation of the East Africa Development Program, including potential leaders, the cost of job creation, and the type of job that we created. Over the last 2 years, we're paying more and increasing attention to that, so that we optimize the amount of money we spend on job creation. We go to propose registration of institutional landscape trusts. Not only the program, I think you're familiar with, but the limitations here that we might not have adequate resources and skills to draw the land use tax certificates for launching of these registers once the LDA has been promulgated, actually. And you'll see that increasingly going forward in terms of the new initiatives, the policies and legislation that we've put in place. That we need to do something about the competency profile of our employees. And so this year we started an intensive training and retraining and reskilling program so that we can capacitate the companies in that regard. The deemed registry is a mentor bill. Well, this is much to have for approval for publication for our comments in March or April of this year. And the current skills and competencies, you'll see again that these registries are inadequate to implement the proposed bill at this point. So the high risk that has been identified as requirements is supporting a broad institutional transformation program that will improve policy and legislation, change management, business strategy, community, and an enterprise architecture review to ensure the success of this amazing goal. We have the realignment of the deep registry areas of jurisdiction to provincial boundaries. Our deep boundaries currently are in presence based on the old provinces. To a large extent and the homeland, and we need to bring that in line with the 9 provinces that we currently have, and so we started a project in that regard. And you'll see that the successful implementation of the program will be hindered by the lack of internal capacity on the one hand, but before we are hopeful that that can be overcome because of these operations in trading accounts, and then resisted by the legal development. To having to make sure that our deed pockets are located strategically for the Mexican country. So we fixed up some resistance from the legal fraternity, we fixed up some resistance in terms of then with regard to either moving over to a electronic deed registration process where you can actually lodge your deed anywhere in the country. The moment you have to be in the province in which you are first acquired in the property. Private conveyances have already displayed it as a suspect, just as much as the possible dedication of private deed pockets to my king. And this has been already in court already. So on many fronts we've set up a whole lot of problems with this, but our approach has been, okay, there's a problem, there's a challenge, let's see how we can deal with it and move beyond that so that the ultimate goal is actually achieved. Then you go into strategic intervention, our folks are using their own food, not only is 10,268 for the period from 2014. Project implementation rural communities to improve production support of improved food security. There's a whole lot of initiatives, and I think the second report that I will make available once it's been presented to the portfolio mission, and that will give you more insight into that one. Then the review of performance targets up to 2014-15. I'm not going to go through that. This is basically the progress that I alluded to at the start, that we have the process structured along. And so we have, in terms of land names, but either that submission will be here tomorrow. You have basically 1,755 that will settle over the period and 877 finalized. You're familiar, I think you're not familiar with the difference between the settled and the finalized. And then in terms of land acquisition, 1.4 million hectares have been acquired, recap, 1,496 farms have been acquired or recapitalized. Late tenure classification finals have indicated 98. Reopening of land taking purpose that's been successfully reopened. We basically have 40 lodgement offices that are fully operational. Now the 6 mobile offices fully operational, which go into the deep rural areas and into the semi-rural areas in terms of making the service available to people. And you can see the product of that has been 123,551 claims have already been submitted on the 19th of January. And they were all in the system and being worked on. As you can make it well aware, we're even priority now to the plans of the previous period that have not been settled to try and run that away. And I'm sure the Commission will provide updates of that tomorrow. the capacitation of armies over the period 2002 and the number of hectares of state land in the former homeland that has been surveyed, and will be 3.3 million hectares that have already been surveyed. The state land register verified 100% of the indicated previously. We've already established the Office of the Valuer General. We are now providing support to the Valuer General to get its structure sorted out and to establish their office in an independent building project, etc. to ensure that the Valuer General retains its autonomy as it is in the legislation and in the attributes that are indicated how it presents. Infrastructure projects that have been facilitated, 45,867. We've got a detailed list of those 45,847, and this is the development part of the department. The unit is also responsible for the implementation of the AgriPark, and I'll talk about that in our projection to the next 5 years. All the enterprises supported, 947. Again, we have a detailed list of all the projects that are supported. Then improve food security, the households of 10,210 jobs created, 22,564 jobs have been created over that period in rural areas across all our programs. Geomatics training, due to the scarcity of the skills and the various digital process, we had a dedicated training program in place, and over the period we've been able to basically fully trained 180 people. The continuous program, and now we've started to train people for the private sector as well, because we have sufficient resources within the budget that's allocated to us. Then we have skills development, 27,366 development and skills development opportunities provided, and then we recruited 25,197 youth over the PH-596 program. And interestingly, we're getting calls now that the United States program should become a huge national initiative for young people in the country, in addition to going to your urban areas and not only the rural areas. And so that requires just another kind of investigation and look at how we can make it happen. But we're very happy with the progress. We reviewed the program. It's no longer 4 years, 2 years. And a lot of the young people who come through this program, I've found employment or starting their own businesses actually now. The legislation has been approved and we're working with it now. And just in terms of the rural development plan, which become the blueprint of Luna in the rural areas, we find a bit of resistance. But the flip side is it has been a huge cry out for support from our district municipalities to help it to change basically from the pre-1994 way in which our land was managed in town regional planning was done to integrated spatial land use management in the country. So, I mean, it's still very obvious if we go into some of the rural towns where you are the legacy of the past and trying to change that is the first step in terms of that was the legislation and then how these municipalities start their rural development plans. The Property Evaluation Act approved in 2014, the policy that has been approved, I'll go into more detail about that. But we look at the land and the land management commission policy, land tenure security policy for commercial farming areas, the restitution policy are the things that have come through the department the past 5 years and the committee. Then plan policies up to 2019. You'll see that these will closely mirror in the next slide the legislation that we try to move through the legislative process. Again, the process that is largely out of our control once we've made the final draft legislation available. And so at the mercy of the process, so we might say that if I go to the legislative program in the next slide, I think I want to skip this one, which is a duplication. If we go through these next two slides, the moment it comes, leaves the department and goes into the legislative program of parliament and public hearings and the matter comes out. So we might say that we want to conclude it by June, and the chief director legal first successful reports to me the most elements. The harder I hit them, the larger it is factors and out of my control the energy market. So we try and get to the end to promulgate legislation. But this is the legislation that we passed in 2016 2017. I'm told that there's a local government election taking place and Parliament will probably go We're going to die, because the legislation is critical for us to actually to up the tempo for land reform in the country. So the CDA mentioned what the cabinet for public comment in February 2016. The deed registered the mention for all the sent to cabinet also in February 2016. The communal land tenure bill to cabinet for possession for public comment in March 2016. And the regulation of agricultural land held in the cabinet for possession for public comment also March 2016. These ones are ones that require amendments to current legislation, so which are mainly administrative in nature. So you'll see sectional title amendment bill, so 1 and 2 is in May 2016, and it's deed registered amendment bill April 2016, and provision amendment bill April 2016, the land amendment bill May 2016. But these are administrative amendments to the legislation. It is on the previous line, those ones, so the critical ones, which we're trying to pursue. And find it concluded at least in the current position of Parliament. In planned intervention 2016-19. Okay, this is marriage reform. As I highlighted earlier on, we having to relook at our strategic plan and AP, the amendments will bring to the portfolio committee. But the purpose of our geospatial and cadastral services is to provide geospatial information, cadastral service, deed registration and spatial planning, as well as technical services support for sustainable land development. A critical function in land reform. Very critical function in land reform. So we also wanted to, you all are aware of the e-cadastral program, which is not a subject of litigation course, because the Auditor General highlighting certain deficiencies in the way the contract has been managed, and so the FAU have taken over the court case. We at the same time have lodged our own, are in the process of lodging our own litigation matter against the company Gema in consultation obviously with the FAU. But in terms of geospatial information, capital surveys, deed registration, spatial planning, a lot of progress has been made. But we need to move it to the next level of modernization of the program so that we basically make the services available on a broad platform to the entire country from wherever you like to be sitting. Because at the moment you can access it from services at certain points back. Then the branch still utilizes legislation, as I said, to facilitate integrated spatial planning and land use management in all the provinces. This is done in order to address, as I indicated earlier, fragmented spatial planning and uncoordinated settlement plans. The big priority at the moment is the rural development plan, which is the blueprint for development within our rural areas. It's a target of to complete on all of it for every decision that's covered at the end of the performance cycle, which is the end of March. As of last week, we had more than 70% of them complete already, and we're waiting for 30 municipality councils to adopt the rural development plan. Some of them, because the delay has been caused, because they wanted to make sure it's integrated into the IDP going forward. And then to deal sufficiently with incomplete and non-reform land administration systems, the Department of Social Comprehensive Integrated Land Administration, which I spoke about earlier. And then I spoke about the cadastral service and I spoke about the rural development plan. Then in terms of rural development, rural economy transformation, you're familiar with the third paragraph, that is the third one that provides support to rural communities and prioritize rules to enable them to improve their livelihoods by 2090. A huge program and project of this department is the AgriPark infrastructure project. And over the next few years, we want to drive this initiative in all 45 district municipalities. There's been huge interest between municipalities and the private sector in wanting to join us in implementing this initiative. And we see the figures are pretty impressive, the codes we're putting in place and plans we're putting in place. Leaders believe that we can achieve those targets in all of this. 1,000 enterprises supported 14,000 skills development opportunities and 14,200 job opportunities will be provided through rural development initiatives. And you'll see market certainty and amplified support will be provided to 250,000 small scale farms. The establishment of 80,000 more and committed to the MTA. Enterprises give a job of staying and merger. So it's a bold initiative being undertaken, and it forced us to basically make sure that we work with a whole lot of role players and stakeholders in this particular field. Enterprise development or program supported beneficiaries in the agri-box, which has forced us to realign the way that we also did things. So we basically put our rural enterprise program and a rural infrastructure development program under one branch. Now we've operated Tetris in the park and now in one of the Centralia Farmer Production Support Units, agricultural enterprises within that identify the agricultural commodities as well as the logistic development enterprises. It would be good if we can get the opportunity to provide the Commission with an update on how we progress with regard to agri-farms in the country. I've said about the partnerships that we're entering into. We've also entered into a transversal agreement for the Department of Small Business Development in order to guard the problem of duplication, double dipping, as well as ongoing dependence on government to ensure sustainability. As I indicated earlier, this much improved cooperation at national level between national departments as a result of a number of initiatives that are being embarked upon. Rural enterprises still lack access to markets and more attention will be given to the product improvement support. The rural urban linkages will be strengthened at ground level since with the production perspective of the agri-farm to have a competitive edge for the commercial farm product. And again, we focus in on the small farmer producers and giving them access to the market. And if I talk about small business development, we're exploring linkages with the Department of Social Development and Correctional Services who have indicated willingness to procure from us the products that come out of these agri-farms that have been established in the rest of the country. So those are how we intend the things that we're busy looking at this particular land redistribution and development, the other legacy departments. Key drivers of land is the restoration of land rights and certain forms of equitable region. The department ensures that enabling legislation is part of already highlighted previously in order to deal with all issues pertaining to land claims and fast-track processes. The next one is in the Recap and Development Program provides comprehensive farm development support, and through the program 1,000 farmers will be recapitalized in the MTA and more than 5,000 farmers will be trained. Critical for us in the Recap program is the control mechanism to be put in place to make sure that when we recapitalize the farmers that they can make reductions and that they don't eat that they don't negatively impact the food security of the country. The department aims to promote equitable land distribution and agricultural development by acquiring strategically located land. A huge limitation is the price of land at this particular moment. If you, in certain areas, I'm say that, the drought has again a flip side of it, where people are flocking the land onto the land onto market at this particular stage. The position at this particular moment is that we don't want to acquire the land that, in terms of drought, because we'd rather try and assist farmers to keep the farms going. And so you did a few weeks ago a joint meeting between the Department of Agriculture and Farm, the initiatives between us and the five provinces that have been depleted of the in terms of drought, where we're trying to work together to support those particular farmers. And then we have the 50-50 planning policy developed in collaboration with farmers and organized agriculture. We're hoping to make an announcement in that regard soon to take that process forward in terms of the 10 pilot farms in terms of the 50-50 policy framework. Then land redistribution, and this one, and just go into 10-year reform. Functional systems and institutional range for 10 announced administration to enable the greater reform in all provinces remains the priority for us. The department introduced a policy and sent in the relative rights of people working in order to improve the conditions of our labour tenants. The main a concern in certain provinces for us, in that we after the fact become aware of certain tenants, labour tenant issues. The ethical is that an advanced stage towards completion is taken and has been taken to the parliamentary process will assist 1,310 CDAs to comply with the Act over the end of the period and settle more than 1,000 labour tenant applications. The 50-50 travel policy and establishment secure tenant opportunities in the enterprise will deliver the target 10, will do this for 2013 and 13 for 2016-17. And we were together with our organised agriculture collaboration of this project prize and as announced in 2015 said as it is in this year we can hope to make an announcement in this regard. The extension of the period of 10-year mental policy most likely to be extended into law in the current year and will provide people the opportunity to claim those extensively on farm arrangements that this legislation calls for, as well as all farm systems for those children's option, as well as for the millions that have been evicted and retrenched over the years. That's the next thing for us. Types of all farm settlements, all in the digitalography, as well as solving subjective problems, would be supported. We need to get a handle on the farm evictions and retention on our farms, especially for the families that are affected by this. The development of special development frames, rural development terms, as well as strategically allocated land for land reforms, will all fuse into a new settlement vision and guide the land to the district of the particular country. So we are hoping to see a convergence of a whole lot of things that will help us in going broad land use in our country. In terms of institution, briefly, only a touching on this because I'll be addressing the committee tomorrow. In response to the plan of economy of the Commission has developed a standalone strategic plan for 2015 to 2020, and they'll be addressing, they'll be reporting separately, apart from the separate from the department in the coming year and beyond that. The autonomy program is a process of transforming the Commission to efficient and profit sector organisations that includes the experience of our constituents, of which coming autonomous is just one project. This project is underway, and this sub-project has been completed already in this year. In light of recent budget cuts, the strategy and plan for the reconfiguration and the restructuring of this will have to be reassessed, similar to how the department having to reassess its own structure. And in terms of the HR, I requested the Commission related to the 4,635 total in our department. And this was separate from the D structure, as we call the operator trading hub, and we have 425 vacant posts. It might sound extremely high in this particular, but when you analyze it a bit more, you'll find that we, on a month-to-month basis, we employ 50 people. We have about 40 to 50 people who exited the employer department or promoted internally. And so you basically have this number staying constant, and we're trying to see how we can improve that so that we actually go into a plus for the department and reduce the number of vacant posts. Having said that, the budget cuts will impact on the number of posts that we are allowed to fill. The organization has currently been reviewed and aligned to the mandate and purpose delivery of the department. The minister has also embarked upon the process to make sure that our structure is aligned to the mandate that Parliament and even the Department to execute. And we hope to complete this project in 2015 and 2016 with the revised organogram being implemented over 3 years. And also to say that the revised organogram will be designed according to the budget that has been allocated. Our organogram has never in the past 5 years been aligned to budget allocation. So going forward, we need to make sure we've got R1 million, but only to a structure that can be funded from R1 million. And previously, we had a structure that would have cost about R4 billion, and we only had R2 billion available. So you see, we've got 11,000 posts for the structure, and we could only afford 4,000 to country. People management, we basically, as indicated, going to increase training and skilling opportunities. We've done skills audit in the final phase of it. And trying to make sure that we have the right people in the right jobs going forward, and we don't have that to provide training opportunities and skill development opportunities so that they'll be able to execute their jobs. We're also making sure that we have standard operational procedures for each and every function that we perform in the department. At the moment, there's quite a deficiency in that regard, and we're also doing business process mapping and making sure that every program in the department is mapped. So going forward, we can use the blueprints in order to go and, like we do in the online recruitment, to be able to move it into the digital process. Then just in terms of our policy financial implications, I'm going to go quickly through that because we've got a summary slide right at the end. You are aware of the legislation that we're pushing through Parliament, the parliamentary process, but there are cost implications to it. So if we look at the communal land law amendment or the estimated cost summary, it's R2 billion on an annual basis. Over a 20-year period, you'll see that we've broken down the cost over a 20-year period. But on an annual basis, you'll see we'll require R2 billion.
If we take out of that the cost associated with budgetized, the general plan compatible with acquisition of land, it goes down quite substantially. If you touch that, then becomes a piece of legislation that we cannot actually fully implement going forward. So in terms of a straightforward answer, and that is the presidency insisting that whenever we draft a piece of legislation, you have to do an environmental impact assessment to ensure that you know what the full implication is of the legislation that is drafted. So if we go through some of this, you'll see, let's just go through one. I don't want to go into much detail of these things. On this line, slide 45, you'll see there's a registrar, the CPA, that has to be created in terms of the legislation. So in the Department of Organic Land, we have to make provision for that. So the legislation says that as it goes, you must be able to tell Parliament that you are actually budgeting for that, or you've gone to Treasury and tell them you've asked for money to create that budget. Otherwise, the legislation cannot be basically signed into law by the president once it goes through the whole process. So we've done the assessment, we call it here, of all the pending legislation. We currently have a team looking through all the pieces so that they highlight the cost implications, the structural impact, and what resources we have to put in place to make sure that this legislation can actually be successfully implemented going forward. I want to go to the summary slide to do it, because I think I have to take it up by 7 minutes to share with them. This is the regulation of landholding bills, and this is the exclusion cost that we take out certain other things. And then we go to the summary of all three orders, which is in 550. And you see that when the grand total of all three, if you look at 75 billion rand, average cost per annum 3 billion rand, just in terms of enactment and making sure that we are ready as a department to enable the legislation. I guess these are the exclusions in the terms of if that's 3 billion, it goes up to 918 million rand, at least 1 billion rand that we need. But then again, it also weakens the impact of the legislation going forward. So we have to face it, and we sit with National Treasury, we sit with a whole lot of old players, so this is what we're going to need over a 2-year period to make the impact, the implementation of the legislation possible. And this is just the financial impact on the establishment and going forward, as I indicated to you. And this line should have been when we spoke about the APR, I think, around here. Obviously, it would be low. It would be a deficit for each financial year, over 1 billion rand at the end here, that Treasury will be cutting from our budget going forward. So in terms of the employment of staff members going forward, we are looking at the reduced budget, so we're not going to be able to basically solve all our agencies going forward. I think that's my last slide in a nutshell. Thank you, Chairman.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. You have been giving 10 minutes to mention a few of the things, because it's important, because as the portfolio committee, much of what you outlined, I think that we will be monitoring, even if you do oversight. Can I immediately hand over to the Honourable Chief Justice Ngwenya Ngonyama? Colleagues and other members, you have seen that we skipped the tea, we didn't even leave it. So anyone wishes to go out and get a cup, you're most welcome to do so, but we want to save on time.
Thank you, Chairperson, for today. Honourable members and all present, I have noted that we have to try and meet the time that is available. My presentation is a short one, but with your permission, Chairperson, may I just make a few remarks as a prelude to my presentation. that when we received the invitation to do a presentation today, apart from noting what was obvious, I asked myself that seeing that this presentation was in the context of a workshop, what did the committee expect of us other than just giving the performance achievement? And one of the thoughts that came to mind was perhaps the committee also wants to know whether we are acting and working within our mandate. And then I thought maybe I should make a few remarks as far as that is concerned. But the brief and short of our presentation today, if I may outline it, is that the Ngonyama Trust have identified its activity and classified them into these three. One is the land administration. The other one is the support to traditional communities. The other one is administration, which we classify as an offshore corporate government and service excellence. And if I move to the next slide, one of our performance indicators in the administration was the number of land tenure rights concluded, and the other one was land holding rates and maintenance on quarterly basis, and the other one was number of planned land management projects. With regards to number of tenure rights allocated, I think the numbers speak for themselves from 2010-2011 to 2014-2015. But if you allow me, Chairperson, while on this call, maybe to amplify this, because it presupposes that we deal with land where effectively there are no tenure rights. I think the correct description and codification should be we are recording the existing rights, because the land that the Ngonyama Trust Board administers, it does so at the instance of government, but for the benefit of the owners of the land that are already in place. And the most important thing with this is that the people living under communal land and under indigenous or customary law have been unfortunate from days of colonial times, or since the registration of rights in this office, the owners in these pieces of land have always been treated as if they are not owners. Their rights have been treated as personal rights, as opposed to real rights that must be reflected in this office. So ours is not really to allocate new rights, but within the constraints available, we are documenting rights to a limited extent, so that once there is uniform legislation in this regard, these rights could easily be adjusted in this regard. And I will elaborate on this further on. So we say this is what we are doing with limited resources that are available. We could be doing more. The landholding register, it must be noted that we manage or administer a register where rights or pieces of land come in and some pieces of land go out. The next slide underscores what I'm saying. It would be noted that part of the project of the IGB has been the transfer of what we call black townships, which were we created or established internal proclamation R293 of 1962. In terms of our own legislation, those pieces of land were to be transferred to the municipalities. Again, like I said, is the unfortunate part, because the two owners of the land are still awaiting a uniform policy to get documents. So whether it's the government or Ingonyama Trust Board, these are nominal owners because they are just holding title deeds, but they are not the true owners. So the perception that always gets created as if land will go to somebody else is incorrect, because the people who are entitled to appropriate instruments of land ownership are the beneficial occupants at this stage, whom I have already said that at this stage their rights are treated as personal rights as opposed to real rights. So there were about 28 townships that settled within Ingonyama Trust land. Some of these townships were then integrated into others. As a result, we ended up with about 25 of them. 24 of these have already been transferred to various municipalities. What remains is only one township, because of complex land legal issues, which I do not intend at this stage for this committee with, unless I am afforded a space at some particular stage. Furthermore, land that is allocated for housing as well as infrastructure projects is part of what we deal with on a regular basis. It would be noted that under this indicator, we say in the year 2014, 20 development rights, which are the agreements the Ingonyama Trust Board enters with municipalities, were entered into, and these resulted into a project whereby 43,000 housing units, these are government-sponsored housing or RDP houses, were constructed. The next phase, we deal with projects. These again are part of the projects that relate to communities. We have listed all of them, or most of them. Then, I do recall that about 2 years back, the item which appeared in Somerset Junction, which was a retail property development, it was one of the projects that was shown to the portfolio committee as it was then constituted. I can also elaborate how these projects come about, but they belong to the local communities jointly with private investors. The next slide deals with workshops, and these workshops really are intended for development of capacity building to members of traditional councils, and the numbers speak for themselves. The educational awards up until the period under review were only confined to those areas where there were sufficient money for allocation, and the board was only helping the administration, but it is the local people that identify students that deserve the awards, and they recommend them, and the board processes payments because it is the custodian of their finances. We have also listed other support to traditional councils, and they are listed. And maybe to clarify one item so that it is clear, the one which says administration costs and salary of certain traditional councils. Maybe this deals with the secretaries of traditional councils, because what happens is, in terms of the provincial arrangement, secretaries to traditional councils are employees of traditional councils. And in most instances, you find that they've got insufficient money on their own, and they request the board to administer the payment of salaries to their personnel in the form of sacrifice. And also, this does not only restrict itself to payment of salary, but also ensure compliance with labor relations, as well as the requirements of the Department of Labor. The uniform there, on all occasions, traditional council who got additional funds in custody of the Wanyama Trust would sometimes identify students who are in need of school uniform, who cannot afford, and they request that from their funds, these monies be utilized to purchase uniform for particular pupils or students. The next slide deals with the corporate governance. That is how the board is constituted, compliance with PFMA, staffing and organogram. Measures that have been raised by the committee as matters of concern around the staffing have been substantially addressed with the hope that by the beginning of the coming financial year, those would be matters of history. But it still doesn't do away with the fact that as a result of the delay in getting an approved organogram, the secretariat of the Wanyama Trust will still remain hugely under-resourced. We also deal here with the infrastructure development. It would be noted that for a good measure of the existence of the board, it operated from within the offices of provincial offices of the Department of Land Reform, Rural Development and Land Reform. And the priorities, of course, for the department will always compete with those of the board. And in this result, in 2011, the board acquiring its own offices, which were purchased after compliance with the provisions of the PFMA, whereby we have to get the minister's endorsement in acquiring that property, and thereafter the property was acquired and first developed. And then in 2013, there was a need for a satellite office, and that satellite office is in place, but the lease is coming to an end, and there is a view that that office needs to shift slightly from the premises where it is located as a result of a number of constraints, one being that we've got only three parkings and the service communities, which normally come in large numbers, and we share the boardroom there. But that is what I am presenting to this committee for purposes of today. These are challenges as well. While in one breath, and at a principal level, there were huge steps forward, but they also remain constrained. Because it would be noted that the land that's administered by the board is close to 3 million hectares. And it's occupied by people in excess of 5 million. So with the current staffing and current office infrastructure, we cannot claim that we are doing justice in servicing those communities. Moving further, the changes in legislation have different impacts, like the loss of royalties by various communities, and this income now residing within the National Treasury, and those communities do not know how to access it. But we believe with the guidance and ongoing interaction, we'll be able to deal with the matter in the near future. The other challenge has to do with audit qualification. The board misconception has found the qualification by the Auditor General. In particular, the qualification has to do with valuation of land. I may say that historically, the Auditor General qualified the board at least on three major themes. One was at the time when Bob was first audited. The Auditor General found that the board was indebted to Etiwili Municipality for this part rate, and that it did not make adequate provision. The board was of the view that there was a contested matter which should not have received qualification, and indeed the matter some years later was resolved by the court, which found in the board's favor. The other qualification has to do with the valuation of land. That challenge will be ongoing for a while, because initially the board did put the value on land, and the Auditor General questioned the methodology. And then the board, on the advice of the Auditor General, decided not to put value, aligning itself with the executive authority, because the Department of Land Affairs, which is now Department of Rural Development and Land Reform, does not put value on the land it owns. And it was the advice of the Auditor General that we would do likewise. Lo and behold, we followed that. Again, we got qualified. We have made attempts to find a solution. Also, on the advice of this committee, by approaching the Accountant General, of looking at a GIPA and an alternative methods. All I can say, as far as that is concerned, is that there is a measure for ongoing discussion. That then deals with the past 5 years as far as this goes. And then the part two of the brief was that we deal with the matters moving forward, 2015 to 2019, although we just went overboard by a year. We have set out our specific objectives, provide effective monitoring and evaluation systems to the Ngonyama Transport, and to effective stakeholders, and give measurable performance indicators. Chairperson, I propose that the committee can look at the first slide in that regard, which is problem one, but I propose that I deal with the, in some detail, problem two, which is the provision of secure tenures to facilitate development on Ngonyama Transport. I do so because I think this is one area which requires legislative directive in large measure and a political leadership to a greater extent. I say this because, in my view, the real issue is, why are people in communal land treated differently as far as their ownership of land is concerned? There are many theories people just walk around with. The truth of the matter is, even in the proposed communal land bill, I don't think it addresses that situation. Because the proposal, as I've seen it, is that this land, which is already occupied by the two owners, but the proposal says it's not owned by them, it should go to traditional councils. What for? I don't know. I suppose there would be better understanding in my definition that communal land can always be contextualized. Just like sectional title, in my view, is communal land, with specific legislation and specific governance. Under communal land, would communal land which in some instances owned by CDAs, in some instances owned by trusts, just like one of my trusts is just by one of them, you need to contextualize between the owners of land and the governance of that communal setup. That, in my view, I think is something that Ngonyama Trust has been evolving over the years to try and illustrate. So I'm saying, therefore, in that context, we will continue giving the instrument, which at this stage we use as a lease as opposed to nothing, knowing those are transitional measures pending the final legislative word in this regard. We will also maintain an integrated and comprehensive land tenure administration system, in other words, database of land tenure rights, making such land available for development, not only infrastructure, but for other development. Because the land we are referring to is not available in settlers. The legislative process is far slower than what is happening on the ground. Land that was vacant 5 years ago is fully occupied, and those people are protected by all rights that both the Constitution and other legislation have made available. So, in practice, my view, Ngonyamakas, the idea that has carte blanche administration is not necessarily correct, because the people that do the allocation on the ground are traditional councils. And we intend to provide some strategic oversight and assistance. So when we say we make land available, we mean within the constraint of what the people on the ground believe should be made available for development. And when we say a sole legal occupation of trust land, we are merely alluding to one thing. There is massive land invasion that we say we help traditional councils as structures in many instances to ensure legal occupation by taking those who occupy land illegally to court. That is one thing we see ourselves doing moving forward. And the program, the third program, is the support to beneficial communities to improve food security. In this regard, we do this jointly with the department in many areas, as well as the Department of Agriculture. Likewise, with economic facilitation of economic development, we do these things jointly with other entities of state as well as private sector and government department. Likewise, identifying strategically located lands to be utilized for high impact commercial ventures. These are processes that are similar to what I have dealt with on page 3 on the slide, which deals with projects on Ngonyama land where Ojozini Town Center and Ojozini Tiger Lodge. Those would be similar projects. Program 4, we provide training to traditional candles as well as other community structures for purposes of enabling them to do better in terms of their administration of land, but also of taking cognizance of the legislative development. Facilitate skills development for young people living on communal land. That is part of community support, and I do not think that we make much difference except that communities and government have got a number of problems around youth development. With regards to mining on trust land, I think we have said enough here. We had our first conference, for want of a better word, a workshop in August 2015, where at the pressure of various communities, we had to invite mining houses as well as community structures and other role players. The reason for that is that land is not only about the surface, but it deals with other matters relating to land, like mineral resources, like water, and things like that. There are a few policies that we have highlighted in our past reports. Some of them have now been approved by the board, some are still work in progress. If I may add in this regard, the issue of legislative development is that the Ngonyama Trust Act has not been reviewed since 1998, and it requires overhauling, and that we make recommendations to the department, and we do hope that at the very least by the end of the next financial year, there will be substantial judicial amendment, because that has to be in line with and take cognizance of other legislative developments in the country. Financial resources, we deal with that, and I think what is not mentioned here yet, but just to illustrate to this committee, is that in the year under review, which is 2015-2016, the budget of Ngonyama Trust Board was in the tune of about 85 million rand. The transfer of a grant from the department was in the tune of about 18 million. I'm sorry that we did not put this figure in Chairperson because of the haste with which we had to prepare this document. But mainly what we are saying is this is substantially a self-funding enterprise. The truth is, if the government were to absorb the cost of communal land in KwaZulu-Natal transition, the budget is huge. Because to do survey, to prepare and ultimately register each individual who is entitled to a title deed gets, I think with the available state resources and everything else, that itself is a challenge. So we are saying, therefore, we substantially fund ourselves as a board, and that the funding is utilized for administration and further distribution for communities. And there's still a fair amount of money that needs distribution to communities, but there are a number of requisites before those monies could be transferred to the various communities and deal with that at a later stage. And we say the capital expenditure is entirely paid from the trading activities of the board, not from the transfer payment, which is the money that comes from the minister, which is only used for administration purposes, mainly the payment of service. I think Chairperson, the rest in part speaks for itself. I wish to thank you. I can only elaborate and answer questions at relevant time. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Colleagues, we have come to the end of the two critical and important presentations that have been made by the department and by the ITB. I wish to open the floor now for questions or clarifications, any additions. So it's open.
Thank you very much, may I start policy. If you've seen this kind of things, I don't advise anyone to try it at home. I've been asking to a yet I was still a member of the to arrive here. I stay very quiet before. I'm not saying more than anyone else, but I'm just emphasizing. So my policy check for late arrival. Again, if you go through my system, you see that the password has expired. So the communication emails that were regarding the program, and I see my name written somewhere, definitely couldn't reach my ears earlier. Although it was very political, it was insane on TV for blockages and all these kind of social evils. So it was difficult to hear this by yesterday with all that kind of strife there. I sincerely apologize for the arrival. Which, then private disoriented as I may be, but it will help workshop with the platform to clarify other. I think if it's in the other forthcoming presentations, you'll rule me as such. If not, I would suppose that DVG Southgate could have just said something on Sploma implementation. I feel the impression that with the Sploma regulations and the effect data may be there. Professor Sulai from that last year, 2015, then it would have meant great, great cabin of land invasion, as he doesn't call that. If perhaps I'm on point, if not, can't get anywhere else, I was then specifically going to ask the question to DDG to say, if Pluma rollout and the regulation really effective, because for the first time the other day I called the DG and said, hey, in my own backyard I see land grabbing, you know, and how does it, is it real active, does it have team? Is it weather in court? What do you do? I'm just talking practically now. I see the big picture and police water, but practically, what do you do in a situation where that land grabbing is just rampant? I wouldn't want to say at the present stage it's true that my colleagues can find it. I would say perhaps it's just individual greed and ignorance of the public about whenever they see open and people just start putting in shakes or whatever, or grabbing. The last here to the question here, I asked the DG. But in that land grabbing, at times you find that the traditional leader may have been involved, and definitely in an erroneous manner in relation to the Pluma regulations of Pluma itself. And in some instances, the extension officers, agriculture. Now, do they think that agriculture department still has mandate on the demarcation of the farms, problem, communal land? I don't know how it manifests itself elsewhere, but in rural outskirts. You find that the agricultural education officer may have been drawn into it. And, I think you have the question is really out of here. Thank you.
Thank you. I think this was also talked about land invasion, how to curb it, etc. DG, the issue of Pluma, it's a tool, it's all out, its implementation, and whether it's a tool to combat land invasion. Good answer, thank you.
Thank you, sir. I think with the Pluma legislation, there's a shift in, not control, Pluma legislation enables the district municipalities and local authorities to put in place the necessary regulations and legislation to deal with the management of land. And so we, as a department, all we do is provide support. And what we're thinking of is that there are a lot of local who do not have the capacity to develop legislation and regulation. So we have entered into an arrangement with the Proctor and other departments where some not even don't have the capacity, they don't have the money to promulgate legislation. So we now provide that kind of support to local authorities. The legislation requires commitment of your local authorities to implement it and to deal with the issue of land grabbing. If there's no will to do that, then you're going to have a problem. But if there's no regulations in place, you're also going to have a problem dealing with it. I'm going to know this is a subject, especially with regard to land grabbing. Now, the second issue is the issue of your Department of Agriculture. No, they don't have a part of that. That's probably entirely within the Department of Rural Development Land Support. So if there are issues with this either problem, then we need to deal with it. Because I don't think it's the Department of Agriculture. I think maybe there might be something else at play.
Thank you. Chair, you want to come in?
Yes.
Maybe just before coming, Chair. The matter that is concerning, especially in the industry where I'm coming from, the Overberg, there's some, this is now directed to TTG, they are concerned with regard to the behavior, the attitude of officials in our department in relation to the kind of support that those who have been receiving small scale farms expecting from the department. That if they complain, say for example, do not want me to raise anything with any senior official because they fear that somehow their complaint, I need to mention where the complaint originates. And they feel that if that is mentioned, then there will be some formal arrangements from the officials that need to assist them on the ground. Now, I don't know, it is a matter that perhaps you at corporate level need to begin to address the change, perhaps the attitude and behavior of staff. The whole issue of prepare, actually must think in change.
Okay, Chairperson, let me start by appreciating the presentation, but also to raise some of the comments on the presentation as presented by the director presented. The first one is on the issue of the feeding of course. I've been listening. The indication was that vacant posts will not be fit. We have to review organogram. But on the other side, you talk of the establishment of the CPA unit, the OVG office. How are you going to deal with those new units that you are aiming to establish if you are not allowed to recruit personnel due to the budget cutoff of compensation of employees? The other one is the issue of you said organogram, the organogram for the past 5 years was not aligned to the budget. Can you explain that? Because the understanding is that the organogram must be aligned to the budget. Each and every just present the organogram indicating the number of the staff establishment, the vacant post, the post to be filled in that particular year, and also at what cost. So if the organogram was not in line, was not aligned to the budget, what was happening? You presented various legislations that are supposed to be tabled in Parliament, but our concern is that I was just looking at the specific date, the time frame, because it talks of March 2015, April 2015, 2016. While you presented the occasional, the annual performance plan for 2015, 2016, there were legislation that you're supposed to present around May 2015, June, July. But some of them were not presented up to this far. So how are you going to deal with those ones, the new ones that you presented, the ones, the specific date? Legislation that are supposed to be presented to the community, because at the end of the day we have to make sure that when you initiate the legislation, those legislation, you follow the proper processes correctly. Secondly, they must be tabled to Parliament on time for the committee to follow the proper processes, so that at the end of the day when it really in part into act, we're not being challenged that there was no sufficient public participation, you know, on that particular law. So how do you make sure that you stick to the specific date which you bring yourself to table the bills in Parliament? The other one you talk about is maybe on the issue of the vacant position or recruitment of the new staff. How is the registration going to cope with that? Because the registration is in the process of autonomy. They have to recruit personnel for them to be able to execute their mandate. So if there's that moratorium that vacant posts must not be filled, they must not recruit, then how are they going to execute their mandate? The impact of the 425 vacant position, what impact is it going to make to the department? Because those vacant positions somewhere were filled, maybe people died or resigned, supposed to fill with the position, maybe others are new positions, but if they're not going to be able to fill those positions, any impact that the department is going to have. I think the issue of the flu has been just covered by the whip. Then with regards to ICT, I think the challenge that we have with the community is the issue of the policies, hoping that that issue is going to be addressed. Because there are lots of things that have been done by ICT, but at the end of the day, there are no guidelines. There's no policy in place to guide the ICT on how to do that. For instance, on the issue of the uniforms, if we can ask, do you have the policy on that? In how many people or learners, you know, you assist during each and every financial year, at what cost? And also, what is about this decrease of the real children after a decision has been taken last month in the state? It's decreased by 1 million, but not the state can judge that the real children has been decreased. Somewhere you mentioned the issue of the accountants general, which were not happy about the, I think, the audit opinion, the evaluation of the, maybe if you can just clarify that one. Then the last one, Chair, I think is the issue of the training of traditional counselors. Each and every financial year, traditional counselors have been trained to a margin, but what is the impact? Are we achieving through those trainings, are we achieving what we are expecting to achieve? One day I was listening to Ingolf on the TV in one of the traditional communities. There was a meeting, I think it was a project that was supposed to be initiated in that community. Then people were complaining that we were not consulted, you know. The traditional council is taking a decision on our behalf. How do you deal with such a situation? Do you follow up? Do you intervene to make sure that at the end of the day, traditional communities are taken on board? Especially also with regards to the revenue that is being generated by that, because we have to account to that traditional community. That each and every community in the financial team must know how much was generated in the traditional community and how are they going to benefit and how much is going to be given for them. We've been arguing about this issue of the 90-10 judge. I think you have also to just unpack it, because it was a thorny issue. That what is the meaning of the 90-10 of 90% because the 10% out of the revenue generation of that of the particular traditional concern. Then the last issue, I think that the review of the ICT, as we have mentioned, that recommendations were made to the department. I think the department has to process that and also make sure that at the end of the day, you know, that process is being finalized. Thank you very much, Chair. Oh, the last one, Mr. Southgate, from UK. Narrative. Why is it committing the oversight visit? What the concern then that some of the narrative learners didn't get their certificate and also the stipend? Can you just clarify that so that at the end of the day, maybe the same understanding we make people follow up, especially because that initiative is not mistaken. But other people, when you read newspapers that have been changed, there's nothing that you are doing, others are sitting typing, what is it?
We have an institution that holds at least who's ready to do a presentation. As we can see, has a time limitation. She needs to be back and get up here at a certain time. So it's with your permission, the Chairperson, I would allow Mr. Southgate and Mr. Sisson to respond, and then we will, if you don't mind, immediately go over to hand over to a professional. And when she puts her input, as well, indeed, is also very relevant to what is presentation has been made. So we will then have another discussion after the presentation. Thank you very much. Is there a question? One more.
said, you made mention of the land of ourselves, and you told something called asset. I just want to know. I don't wish that interest.
I'll be very brief, the putting of the post and how we deal with union, the unionist in Moscow Army Brigade. What we're doing at the moment is we're looking at the entire organogram of all the vacancies and coming up with various options. Where our statutory infrastructure, surveyor general, and the commission, those posts we have to fill. So we find money within the budget. So it's a case of reprioritizing which posts actually need to be rolled in the department. So if the DDG corporate support service first becomes vacant tomorrow, there's not automatic filling on that post. There's a committee that we propose to the department to discuss it, and then maybe we should use the money. And the people is really broken. So for example, when you put online recruitment,
shared services where the data board has their own services at the moment, and so we're saying if you're sitting order one for your shared secretary, and you both have two secretary, you run the two secretary, two and one secretary. And there's a whole lot of other things that we're working on in this particular moment. Now this is, I will look into that shared, but just to say that there, for instance, if you're making your work in progress, there are two things that are there. There are certificates that you have to get from teachers, and your work office is one of them. But he's given me a few amount of spend in about 1,279 certificates we're currently waiting for and being issued. The teachers have had problems with workers and the regular meetings with them to try to relieve the certificates from them. And there's been much improvement in that regard. In terms of the factors, we've got really much stricter control measures in place now. So when they've been on a training program, the United States young people do community work in the non sector. So they have to work in the community. And there are certain people that are appointed to supervise in our department or the local authorities. And then when we do the inspection, district officials inspection and find they're not doing it, we suspend the stipend immediately. Then the United States young person has to come back and say, why are not doing this in the service or the community work factory? And then go into the process of being placed in the service. I don't know any other circumstances under which the stipend is being suspended, if they're not here. It was done on the office of the digital capacity, but it's based on confirmation of the area and a technical creature search they have. So we have to go to control mechanisms in this. I mean, it was today, the auditor general was today in the media as well. Some of our students, people sitting at home, not doing work. So we've reviewed the entire program. And that's no longer for 2 years, but the change and close management of the process of business now in place. But I mean, otherwise, if there are specific incidents, and well, part of the duty is to use the to an investigation like these that can be done. Yes.
Thank you, Chair. They have decreased, in other words, today, not by a million, but we said, at one stage they were 16 million. They have now gone to below a million rand. That's natural, because the treasure is now hitting the chart. So it's not some untoward behavior where it has just disappeared. It's accumulating as well. Maybe for you, Jeff, if I have another explain this longer, the comment on the account of general. One disadvantage the auditor general has is institutional memory. In Guyana Trust Act was passed during the transitional constitution of 1993. The Act subsequently hit between the transitional constitution and the final constitution of 1996. Was then tested whether it complied with the current constitution. Furthermore, what was quite interesting among the political parties, the IFP was the real party in the province. It wanted the Ingonyama Trust to be a public entity. Sorry, I didn't have a say about it. The ANC, by the way, was in the opposition. He said, yes, no problem, but let us take this matter to constitutional court. And the constitutional court fully made up the ANC to say, this is a land and administration court and it's a national court. And what's interesting now, because of absent constitutional memory, ANC is not about the constitutional court that I attempted to do. That's what we are in. So I'm saying, with regards to what we are doing with the accountability now, based on the qualification and comments that have come from this committee, the chairperson is recalled that among others, this committee has taken the decision to facilitate a discussion between the ITV and the Auditor General because of the evident impasse. But nevertheless, we did not stop there. We made some issue to the Accountant General to consider either waiving that requirement, which the Auditor General in our view reasonably. And we suggested what can be done in the meantime to obviate us spending a certain amount of money to pay with the land, or we can get nothing at the end of the day except a reverse certificate. That is where we say the Accountant General is not happy with our proposal to move that route, in other words, not to pay them by the professional members. Like I said, sir, with regards to the same with political leaders, they see on the ground that the people that are. So the training is to ensure that everybody is so we can, that they comply with the constitution. The chairman will be aware of many things that historically there have been instances where a person cannot be allocated less simply because she happens to be a female or he happens to be unmarried. Those are measures which violate everything that is constitutional. So in our view, we believe it does bear fruit, but we have not reached the entire tradition. The other point that the chairperson invited me to comment on is the distribution of specimen policy on 90. I'm not sure that there is a good right now, the chairperson, if I may put it that way. But the most important thing the chairperson would call is that one of the challenges that has been facing what the Max has brought is that we say the communities are entitled to be 90% of the net revenue we see. But at the same time, we're still sitting with that thorny issue of rates. You see, I think we know what rates are payable, what laws have as far as that is concerned. The risk is too huge that we release substantial amounts to communities. And the next thing is, we're facing a huge expense fund if the court has to make a define and decide how to raise the IPD. And then again, we are accused of reckless management. That why can we give money to communities for their needs when they cannot protect the very land that they are fundamental to protect? But that point is not really challenging. At a time that is longer than today, we can take through this committee in many details where there are questions and then we can begin.
Thank you very much. I think the probably after the presentation and next discussion we still need to come back to the issue of the royalty fact, I think the chairperson's question in parlance, she wanted to know if in terms of the royalties collected by the state, paying payable to the state, how come it's been reduced from 60 million to 1 million? The point is, why is this whole royalty then going to it, not supposed to go under the act, which is provision for it? So I'm saying, I'm quite sure that such as perhaps a little number, if you could work on that later, thank you very much. Can we now, in the meantime, welcome Professor Wong to the podium to make a presentation?
Yes.
Good afternoon, everyone. thank you, Chairperson, for the opportunity. Thank you, Chair Honourable Winnie, for this opportunity. I was asked to discuss very briefly an overview of what's been happening with land restitution, redistribution, and farm tenure reform, which are three of the main components of the land reform process. I'm sorry, but maybe Councillors will address the communal tenure issues. I'm so that the decision here on the 2nd of February, 29 years ago, this was a dramatic day. And by June of that year, that government had passed abolition of the Regime-Based Land Measures Act, which repealed the Native Land Act, the Group Areas Act, the Development and Trust Act, and many others. And I think now we see how slow and complicated the process is of moving forward from that. I wanted also to share a memory from that era where a most significant discussion around options for landform in South Africa, the General Secretary of ANC made a statement saying the massively unequal distribution of land is not just the unfortunate legacy of apartheid, it is the totally unacceptable continuation of apartheid. And to a degree, I think that we need to reflect on ways in which there is continuity despite all the many efforts that have been made to reverse that legacy. So, clearly, we have different perspectives about land, and I think that in these debates about land reform, particularly as bringing different stakeholder groups, some people are talking of land as a commodity, as an economic asset, as a form of identity, as part of an unfinished national question, as part of the national democratic revolution. These are complex questions about how land is being shared, by whom, with whom, how. And also importantly, and this is a point I want to come back to at the very end, when we discuss oversight functions of the committee, which is what are the outcomes that we're looking for? So not just how much money is being spent, how many parties are selected, how much land is being transferred, but what outcomes have all of that achieved? And clearly there are different views of what land reform should achieve, and I will mention a few significant changes in policy over the past 20, 21 years. That have actually shifted who the priority target group is for land reform. It are aimed to deregulate access to land, what is the class agenda, and what is the wider political economy, the impact on how people can access and use the land. So, a quick overview. In relation to these three themes of restitution, redistribution, and farm tenure, I've been asked to reflect a little bit on the policy shifts over time, to look at some of the outcomes, what we know about what has been produced through all these efforts, and what are the implications for oversight. With respect to restitution, we know that Section 257 describes the terms of the right to restitution, which is more elaborated in the Act of 1994. But I think it's also important to reflect that in the discussions leading up to the confirmation of the Constitution, restitution was pushed by particularly communities being forcibly removed in relatively recent times who wanted the right to return. And the assumption at the time was that we would be embarking on quite a radical and far-reaching land redistribution process, and the restitution would be very much the headline to that overarching direction of redistribution. But in a sense, this isn't what has happened. The claim process has been long arduous. Of 63,455 claims initially submitted by the deadline of 1998, only 41 were were completed in the first year, and a review proposed an administrative rather than a judicial process, shifting the responsibility onto the Commission and leaving open the route of going to the Land Claims Court only in case of a dispute. But what has the claims process produced? The data available on our institution is actually rather patchy in the public domain. We know most recent public data that you have received from the Commission, which was presented to this committee on the centenary of the Native Land Act, showed a huge provincial variation, some of which is expected, such as in Kaching and the Western Cape, but some is not, and cannot be explained by the volume of change, for instance, in the Eastern Cape and the Free State. There are huge variations in how many claims have been settled with cash status of the land, but there are also big unknowns. At the time, the Chief Land Claims Commissioner in 2003 provided information about unsettled claims. At that stage, a total of about nearly 30,000 claims were not finalized. A combination of claims that were not yet submitted, those that were submitted but not settled, those that were settled but not yet finalized. And we don't know exactly where it stands now, so tomorrow's discussion will be important. But it's also important to know that this is a very different picture across the various provinces. And as the committee discusses with the department and the commission, its constraints in terms of staffing should be important to understand that. What we do know from the available data is that the vast majority of the settled claims are open claims that have been settled with cash. And that of its approximately 50,000 claims that are either not settled or are settled but not finalized, we understand that the bulk of these are royal claims with a large community claim that will be complex and costly to settle. More detailed information about the outstanding claims is therefore essential for this committee to engage robustly with the department and with the commission about its plans to address these issues in the future. A further issue in relation to restitution is, of course, the very limited budget and the ways in which several very large claims have eaten up national budgets. For instance, a couple of years ago, the Mother Mother claim, claiming approximately one-third of the national budget for that financial year. So this is data from the Commission, and project by project, disaggregated data is essential for your monitoring process. CPAs, of course, are the primary legal entities that often establish the claims of settled with restoration of land. And the statements for ongoing responsibilities to support and monitor government. It's encouraging to hear the BBG reporting that that there are plans to re-establish the CPA register and the CPA office of the CPA registrar. But still, we live in a legacy problem of provisional CPAs, which have not been registered and land have been lost or that have been challenged in legal claims against the state, as mentioned in the Makata case. So the CPA amendment law is an important moment, but whether or not that will resolve these issues is not clear. Primarily, the capacity to implement and provide public function in supporting CPAs remains a challenge. What are the actual outcomes of the restitution process? To what degree has it reduced poverty, broadened access to land, and contributed to the higher level policy goals of the land reform process? We actually know very little. What has tended to happen is that every 5 to 10 years the Commission has commissioned research, which has done small surveys and some in-depth case studies. And the most recent national version of this that we're aware of is the 2005 report by the Community Agency for Social Inquiry. And so this is some discussion. What are going to be the outcome indicators that a monitoring and evaluation system can capture on a regular basis in order to update this committee, but also the public at large, about outcomes of restitution. Since 2005, the restitution process in the rural context has undergone a significant change, with the introduction of strategic partnerships as a primary form of settlement of those claims, in which there is typically no subdivision of land, often no settlement on the land by beneficiaries, and several high-profile strategic partnerships. Particularly in high-value land, for instance, in Poco, Brazil, and Mpumalanga, have collapsed repeatedly. So this level of investigation is the problem of the model or the way in which it's been implemented. Oversight of strategic partners and the way in which public money paid commercial partners is being spent is essential. Of course, perhaps the most significant story around the institution right now are the implications of the reopening of the change management process after the 1994 Amendment Act. The projections of the regulatory impact assessments were for up to 379,000 new claims, and we've just heard that already approximately 123,000 new claims have been lodged. This means that there are already approximately two times the number of new claims than were ever lodged in the first phase of the process. We have calculated based on the average rate of settlement of claims, that is not finalization, but settlement of claims, according to the Commission's track record, that at the current rate, average rate of settling claims we've seen since 1995, it would take 144 years to resolve all of those claims, including the older new claims. So I think there are critical questions to be asked, politically, organizationally, and in terms of prioritization and sequencing of claims, particularly in the context where new claims pose very real possibility of substantial numbers overlapping claims, and strategies to deal with that are going to be needed. Of course, some of this is being discussed in the Constitutional Court case to be heard in a couple of weeks' time, dealing with the rights of existing claims who lodged their claims before the 1998 deadline, and how they are to be prioritized or influenced in the process of dealing with both old and new claims. So those are several comments on restitution. With regards to redistribution, contrary to some of the policy statements of the ANC and other liberation movements in the early 1990s, we did not embark on a radical landform process. We made a political choice to embark on market-based landform, models promoted by World Bank. This is not contained in the Constitution. Rather, it is a policy choice in the Constitution that you know provides for expropriation. Although it's not the remit of this committee, I'd like to comment that as class we have welcomed the expropriation bill. In fact, we gave the submission here at the hearings on that bill last year. And the reason is not because governments cannot buy land, but because it matters which land it is and where, not least in the institutional context, but also in the context of redistribution. Redistribution is governed by Act 126 on 1993, which is permissive rather than prescribing exactly how it must be done, which is why the changes in policy over time are of such importance. And I want to emphasize three significant periods of policy driving land redistribution. We had the what we call the SAG years in the first 5 years of the program, which was based on means-tested household grants only for the poor, resulting mostly in large group projects, taking over whole farms typically, and prioritizing settlements and multiple livelihoods. In the second phase, the focus was on agricultural development only, rather than for non-agricultural purposes. The means test was removed, making state grants available to both poor and the not poor, and provided at a range of levels, focusing on commercial farming and those who could enter into commercial farming, but also a safety net for those who could. And although it increased gradually from 2006 onwards, from 2011, the only form of land redistribution under this purpose has been the proactive land acquisition strategy, which involves still a willing buyer willing seller approach, in which the state is the willing buyer, but it is still a market-based approach. This approach was formalized in the State Land Use and Disposal Policy of 2013, which proposed long-term leases. I want to mention here that our fieldwork, only done in the Eastern Cape thus far, shows that there are substantial problems with the implementation of this program, not least the widespread failure of the department to conclude leases for various reasons, resulting in a situation where former farm workers, business people, farmers who are trying to invest in these properties are in a state of uncertainty. And in addition to that, a key finding from our research is that the difficulties in coordinating the functions of this department with that of DAC continue to be fostered at the provincial level with provincial departments of agriculture, particularly with regards to providing support to redistribution beneficiaries. So while the situation is not as bad as restitution, we see a real problem with provision of farming support by DAC on past projects. This brings me also to the issue of the recapitalization and development program on which we held hearings this time last year. substantially divergent opinions emerged then, but presumably there needs to be a follow-up on this, especially the pattern that has been identified, where the department is making recapitalization a prerequisite for allocation of leases. So it seems that in both the leasing and the state land lease and disposal policy, and in terms of allocation of recapitalization loans, there is a fall-off between policy and practice. In all of this, there are two other issues that I want to emphasize. One is that land reform has been redefined as being agricultural development, and that the non-agricultural elements of land reform have been de-emphasized over time. Initially, land reform was intended to provide for a range of different types of land uses flexibly at different scales for different land needs, including settlement, including small settlement settlements, and not only in rural areas, but in peri-urban and urban areas too. So as from 2001, what might be called the risk of redistribution outside of agricultural development seems just to forget, and I think that's an issue that warrants further discussion. As we now are in the phase of the state becoming the owner of all land acquired for redistribution, at least for the first 50 years under the state land lease and disposal policy, we need to have a discussion with the department, I think, about what its position and capacity is for land administration. What kind of landlord is the state? A further issue I want to highlight is the issue of subdivision. While the Subdivision of Agricultural Land Act of 1970 was repealed by Parliament in 1998, it has not been signed into law and remains part of the edifice of a project regulation to protect large-scale farming. With regards to our country's land redistribution, rather at the first institution, most of this is unknown. The Minister in 2009 mentioned a figure of 90% of land reform projects having failed, and he quickly retracted that comment, saying it was general estimates, and in fact there wasn't a basis for that. But the idea, as a mean, no fun, and has been used repeatedly in arguments against land reform. In yesterday's Business Day, the South African Institute of Race Relations used the figure again, 90%, as a reason to attack the expropriation bill. So to strengthen the land reform process, we not only need to get administrative processes right and to strengthen quality, we need to know about the outcomes of land reform. In fact, we have provided something called fact check, just a summary of available survey data from various different studies. And one of these looks at what have been the effects on improvement in livelihoods. And the figures we came up with were very different, but they're also out of date. So I think that all of us are needing better information about what the outcomes of the land reform process are. With regards to tenure reform, I focus only on tenure reform in relation to commercial farming areas and the right of farm growers. The rationale for tenure reform and the reason for the need for it alongside restitution and redistribution is to alter the power relations between owners and occupiers of land. And in a sense, this is an important and potentially radical process of dethroning private property as the most recognized form of land rights, and to upgrade informal rights that can vest in people, not in institutions. Extension of Security to Tenure Act, applying to commercial farming areas, defines occupiers and their rights, prescribes any procedure for eviction of occupiers, but also a most underutilized section of the Act provides for long-term secure tenure rights in Section 4. The 2001 declaratory judgment by the Land Claims Court requires the state to pay for legal representation for indigenous occupiers. And yet, an additional survey conducted in 2003 and 2004 found that, in fact, a very small minority of cases of eviction had gone through the prescribed legal process. The summary of the figures from that survey shows that in the first decade of democracy, that includes 4 years prior to it being promulgated, over 2.3 million people were displaced from farms for a variety of reasons, of whom 940,000 were evicted. So this really is a major category of post-apartheid era dispossession. We need to be talking about not only about apartheid era land dispossession, but also dispossession in the post-apartheid era. Such reform has been badly underused and could potentially be used proactively and strategically to secure, upgrade and expand access to land for farm owners. The European voted case in the Robertson area, which has been in the media, is a prime example of how the Land Rights Management Facility employing private attorneys fails to adequately represent farm owners. In that case, the provisions regarding long-term occupiers were not addressed by either the attorney instructed by the state, nor by the magistrate. And even after an appeal, the family had already been evicted and had not been reinstated. So there are severe challenges in this area, one of which is the absence of dedicated officials to deal with the implementation of EXPA. The Land and Security Policy for Commercial Farming Areas of 2013, which was mentioned previously by the DPD, describes EXPA as a situation of total system failure. And I think that when addressing the EXPA amendment law, when you consider whether total system turnaround is actually achievable through that rule, we will discuss that. We have already submitted a comment on that rule and would be glad to do so further in the future. Now I just want to emphasize that the EFSA amendment bill has a regulatory impact assessment which proposes 374 new projects on the target, which seems like good news. But we need to be clear about whether in fact the services can be created for that purpose, and if not, what the implications for the expanded institutional requirements of a land rights management board, land rights management committees, and the expansion of tenure grants, not only to farm villages, but now to be paid to farm owners, certainly a contentious proposition. But more broadly, this question to be asked, is the justice system working? There are challenges in relation to theft, and there are inability to charge people with violations under Section 23. There are challenges with prosecutors being willing to prosecute cases for infringement of SRF and with magistrates. Such training has been done in the past, but as far as I'm not aware, not for the past 15 years. So more needs to be done. If violations are carry consequences, they have a real demonstration effect. A further permutation of farm tenure or land rent for farm workers is the practice of establishing exit schemes or state buying out usually small minority shares of farms. This is an approach that has an appalling track record according to all independent surveys but also the review conducted on the instruction of the minister, which found that less than 10% of all equity schemes has ever declared any dividends whatsoever. So one has to revisit the question of under what circumstances should public money be going into private commercial enterprises in the name of land reform and in the name of farm workers who don't control decision making. A further issue in relation to farm tenure relates to the Land Reform Labour Tenants Act of 1996. The approach, which of course involves the submission of and process of claims, in the sense makes it somewhat similar to the restitution process. As we understand it, of the approximately 21,000 claims submitted by the extended deadline, very few have been resolved. We only know the numbers in projects, not in terms of numbers of claims. But it's clear that the department was unable to respond to the court order last year to comply with the instruction to clarify its system for processing of claims and to report back. And this matter was heard at the Constitutional Court last week. So I think that assessment of the Labour Tenants Act and states that the department's plans to generalize its implementation strategy is a critical issue oversight. With regards to new policy proposals, the 50-50 policy proposal has been in various forms and redrafted over the past 3 years now. And we understand that pilots are going ahead, but without clarification or confirmation of this policy, just we check, for instance, on what basis expenditure will be made to fund 50% purchase of equity in those enterprises. So, very briefly, these are some of the critical issues, and there isn't scope to get into much detail on many of them. But it's clear that there's a busy year ahead with a lot of upcoming legislation, a lot of which draws from separate new policies that the department has developed. There's the ESCA Amendment Bill, the Expropriation Bill, not going through this department of committee, but nevertheless very relevant to this area of work. The CPA Amendment Bill, Regulation of Land Holdings Bill, and alongside that bill, Another bill was Conservation and Development Agricultural Land Framework Bill, being promoted by DAC, which moved in the opposite direction. Very briefly, the regulation of land holdings bill promoted land clearing with the aim of increasing the supply of land off the market and for acquisition by the state, while the preservation bill proposes land floors and limit subdivision, and at the same time, finally, the appeal to the 1970 Subdivision Act. So I think these two bills together sort of raise the question of what is the overarching direction that we're aiming to go in with regards to changing the distribution of land holdings. Is it to preserve the vast, large farm structure that dominates much of the commercial farming sector, or is it specifically to subdivide and make available smaller units to broaden access to land, which is far from here? And in addition to those, of course, the mineral land renewal, which you'll discuss in a moment. I note, of course, that there is no legislation specifically on redistribution, which continues to be governed by the 1993 Act and policy developed by the Department, most recently the State Land Use and Disposal Policy Government. And yet I thought it's an area in which greater oversight is needed. So what might be priorities for the oversight function of the this committee? The first question I think needs to be asked is, with all of these many new pieces of legislation and new policies, some moving into implementation before finalization, even the consultations continue, is there the white paper that provides an overarching vision? Our current white paper is dated 1997, and it does not in any way describe the range of activities, programs, and activities of this department. So policy direction is key, particularly in the context of fiscal constraints, which are forcing the department to make difficult decisions about better focus. We have this proliferation of new laws and policies, but it's unclear what they add up to and what restructuring of agricultural land or of other types of land we're aiming to achieve. The second issue to address is that of budgets. How much money is there and what will be spent on? We understand that needs to be shared already. And land holding clearly cannot succeed under the current approach of disposing funds not only for acquisition of land, but also diverting large amounts of the land holding budget into other areas. Three important ways in which the very small and shrinking amount of money for land holding has been diverted. One is the recapitalization and development program, which is now being used to capitalize, not just to recapitalize, but to provide initial farming support for land reform projects, and in fact has been applied to restitution projects as well as redistribution. The second way in which funds being diverted away from acquiring land is the proposal in the next amendment bill to provide tenure grants to landowners, not only for providing services, but also in return for providing accommodation. The third way in which funds are being diverted away from acquiring land is the proposal in the 50-50 policy to buy out equity in farms for farm workers. And if we just look at the trend over time, which is quite startling, what we're facing. These are budgets from 2008-9 financial year to current financial year, adjusted for inflation at current rate, at 2015 rate. And what it shows is obviously some volatility, but a very clear decline in both budgets for restitution and for land reform, which covers redistribution as well as tenure reform. What it doesn't clarify there is that the budget for redistribution and tenure reform was further reduced during the interim budget policy in October last year. So within the context of declining budgets and the budgets now being used to address a whole lot of other costs than what they used to, I think that there are questions to be asked of the department about prioritization and policy direction. Finally, third question to oversight is about what is actually going on the ground. And this is where I feel that a very welcome recent initiative in the advisory panel for such treaties to address the question, have our laws achieved what they were meant to, and if not, why not? And we are very delighted that this initiative has been taken, and I'm not surprised that land is one of the primary focus areas. But there are other ways in which the committee can address the question of what's happening on the ground, including field visits and bringing people to you to provide testimony on their experience of these laws. And we as part will commit to support this project in any way we can, for instance sharing with you our field sites We have already a joint field trip with the department at national, provincial, and district level following our infrastructure recap hearing last year. And thirdly, and this is a very specific suggestion, which is that the committee's capacity for oversight seems, at least from the outside, to be somewhat constrained by the way in which the department's activities and achievements are reported. It's very difficult to understand what is a good or a bad report when everything is reported only against annual targets and only reported in aggregate and in total. In order to really understand what's happening on the ground, what we need is better monitoring evaluation programs that produce up-to-date detailed information, proper research according to agreed outcomes indicators, and data on performance that gives information about delivery in detail, both annual and cumulative, so we can see how far along we are to achieving certain goals, and also disaggregated. So my question that I'd like to leave you with is, what are the framework for reporting from the department that would be most useful to your commission? What kind of information do you need to perform this oversight role? And one example would be, for instance, the distribution of budgets in a context where some people and projects are getting lots of money in terms of land acquired and in terms of recapitalization, some are getting little and some are getting none. So in the perspective of developing outcomes indicators, I would suggest pursuing a conversation around outcome indicators and the definition of success and the measures that can be used for assessing that. So thank you again for this opportunity to share with the couple and please have your strategic plan.
Thank you very much, Dr. Brock, for indeed a very insightful presentation. We should be informed that you need to be able to do us as soon as possible. Colleagues, this floor is open as we have indicated earlier. We're going to take questions and also allow questions to the earlier visitors and also allow them to respond. Might I be in general sector? Often have raised issues with regard to the school involved Department of Agriculture and land for in your opinion, do you think there is the argument for the utility systems as separately in the way they are currently, or should there not be any consideration for a senior department to include all of us? And then between the two departments. The reporting framework. I think that the committee will be including the
to him, because he's a third person, you know. The struggles and performance brains and also the animal culture. In most people, they are numerical. They don't, you know, indicate the outcome for the effect of each and every program or the impact.
Yeah.
But you find statistics from each one up to the last page. But we would like to find out really that it makes our work very much difficult. The department of all the departments of indicate like of following the social guidelines. You know. Which is full of statistics. We're not even really with statistics when it's all attacking. Statistics can't be big, but we want to get the impact of that particular program to change the lives of the people. Then, I think from the chapter and the priority, we've been talking also about the study. As the community to check again whether the department uses the allocated resources or it's supposed to use it, you know. Because some of the issues, they are processing issues. Other issues are for the Department of Agriculture, Forestry and Fisheries, other Department of Education, you know. Because looking at the departmental vision, so they are coordinating. They are facilitating the agriculture. But the coordination has eight other departments are not, you know, put or can't do it, what to be of the department, and every day the department has to take that responsibility. We also divert, you know, the budget from their money to other things. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Thank you to this session for all that we have missed. We had a good management discussion last week. We did a lot of that, like the different schools of thought for things that were for just in the room, we have long, long time, and
with the end of the army or whatever it is, really ashes in a terrible way. From any connection to in other missionaries, your academic connection, how the political connection, and what can you influence in terms of reducing the discussion for the poor? To give me 50 years, you know, to give me 50 years to finish up the work of the restitution, because this hasn't been for a long time. Maybe it has taken down something more here to colonize and discover but something for the poor is just possibly unacceptable in the last week to the concurrent world. Chair, the last comment was on the appropriation of the eye of picking up the things, pick up the things resolution by the public work that each has a good skill of to property provide the immovable property, although that is talking about all properties, including the intellectual property, eyes and so forth. But in particular could unlock a lot of potential to really advance on the content question. So the chair is good, perhaps a very strategy also by our chief. It would be good to also get the input of plus chair in a very bad note that they made an input to the exploration team who I think we should be very interested in that it can help us a great they said, I don't know how the department is going to get the issue to also engage with the issues. Because we're seeking answering the solutions. There's no attack and defense. We just follow one and the people trying to help us to help out to transform on the top of the system.
Thank you.
Is
anyone else? Come on,
one member, the EFTA actually applies to rural communities in Pakistan. Why come from this provision to the police and permanently? Pakistan was one of his chief engineering lenders that he lost because of apartheid in the pronouncement, which was hostile to those people have paid in terms of expenses. extent and an extent that people may have feelings. I think in the next 10 years, there will be definitely big detection files and lots of bloodshed. People will handle this problem.
Thanks.
and I wouldn't want to pretend on the argument for separate or joint departments, just to say it has been a very interesting experience in other parts of the world, particularly in Latin America, of having a growing form of agencies that deal with both the agricultural and economic aspects of a changing farming sector alongside the land rights issues. But establishing such a thing would be a massive undertaking, and I think that it wouldn't be fair to pretend on the issue of institutional arrangements now. What I would like to add on institutions, though, is that in the array of new proposed legislation, quite a lot of new institutions are being proposed. We have now a new office of the auditor's help, the value of general. The SMN bill proposes to establish a land rights management board. We already have a land rights management facility. We're going to establish a land rights management committee at district level, but there are also district and reform committees being established now. And the new land rights bill proposes the creation of a land management board in addition to all of these. And that is quite an array of new institutions, many of which are proposed to take on functions that are already part of the Department of Responsibility. So I think that therein, that dealing one by one of these pieces of legislation is not the most helpful way. One has to look at the whole picture of institutional arrangements for building land reform and managing land rights across the different areas. And in fact, having institutions that manage land rights not necessarily specifically in the communal areas versus commercial farming areas. Our existing white paper makes an argument for a unified tenure system with different options available to people, how they would like to hold their land and how it should be governed, rather than us necessarily having segregation in our approach to land rights between the former communal areas and commercial farming areas. We've just put in our amendment bill submission next, as it is with your secretary. On the issue of municipality control, this is absolutely critical. And in the district land reform committees and the land rights management committees, a lot of the hinges on the involvement of municipalities, which has been tried through the area-based planning program since 2006, and has actually been quite disappointing that attempts to get municipalities to play a key role. One of the important things that could be done in ESTA is strengthen the role of municipalities and to ensure that responding to threatened or actual evictions becomes part of IT processes, becomes part of municipality planning, is to require that municipalities respond to Section 92D notices and submit to the court probation report in terms of Section 93. So eviction proceedings are going ahead and eviction orders issued in the absence of such probation reports that should contain critical information about the potential impact of these evictions, the availability of alternative accommodation, and other issues. I'm glad you have taken on all the issues in our management facility. On the reporting framework suggestion, I think that there are challenges certainly for the department to gather adequate information from all of their districts and central offices. At the same time, the reports that meet current measuring requirements, which focus on delivery, are not the same as the type of reports that would focus on outcomes. But even within reporting on delivery, more aggregated information is possible on the basis of the existing information held by the department and could be made available. With regard to the question about restitution and 144 years, my view is that when these debates were held during the public hearing on the reopening of the restitution process, indications were made abundantly clear, and Parliament did approve of this bill, knowing the potential scale of these of new things, and the very foreseeable issues about overlapping claims and legacy debates. So I think it is possible that, particularly after closure of the reopening process in 2019, that a new strategy could be adopted to cluster claims, to have local processes to resolve claims, to address cases where there are overlapping claims. But a lot of this work would have to be done, and an investigation done even before that is possible, to map claims, to identify where they are. Even now, clarifying where are the outcomes of claims, what is the scale of them, how many people are involved, or how much land, what actually cost, and what the timeline for completion of the existing claims is crucial, not least to respond to the case that is now at the Constitutional Court on the issue of how to deal with old versus new claims. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Ms. Bowman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you.
actually it's not probably I think it will be a good thing now. What do you want to think about? It's certainly probably looking forward to your next presentation.
Yeah,
but colleagues, it's now possible. And I think it's time for the A-Lance break. With your conversation, I wish to address anything. Can we please our hour? Sufficient?
Yeah.
I thank you very much for your gentleman.
Thank you.